from them, and they never do it.
Is it on?
Yes.
All right.
It's running. So tonight we have Kathy Taylor talking about the beginning of life issues. And I guess we can go around and just introduce ourselves. So Kathy, everybody here.
Yeah, some of you I know and some I don't. So
I'm Jeff Lux. I'm in the bioethics program. I just graduated from college at the University of Wisconsin. And like I said, my first day was a complete novice for law and bioethics. So, you know, here we are.
Great.
You know me?
Yes.
You're from an ethics class?
Yes.
Lindsay Middlecamp, law student and bioethics master's. Pretty much the same, except my name is Stephanie.
I'm Logan, I'm a law student.
Okay.
I'm Tom, I'm a law student.
I'm Shauna. I'm a full-time MBE student.
I'm Amy Cassidy. I'm a research coordinator here in psychiatry.
Amy Barenbaum, you know me, right? Mm-hmm. Full-time MBE student.
Jonathan Lukens. I'm in a joint PhD MBE.
Melissa Hogan, and I'm actually an MLA student, but I'm interested in bioethics and public health.
I'm Amy. I'm also a research coordinator in the Department of Psychiatry and the Addictions.
I'm Jessica, I took your last class. I'm a physician and part-time MBE student.
Joe Benson, MBE student.
Alex Spanos, I do this part-time and I'm applying to law school as well.
John Fair, part-time MBE student.
Okay. And hi, we were all just introducing ourselves. Would you mind introducing yourself?
I'm Stacey Lane, and I'm an MBE student also at
Shining. Okay. I'm Kathy Taylor, and I teach here at the center. And I am I guess once a lawyer, always a lawyer. But in my previous life, I practiced law for about 8 years before I went back to school to study bioethics. And today I will discuss, as John invited me to, beginning of life issues. I decided not to do the moral status of extracorporeal embryos, stem cell research, all that stuff. It's too much material to cover with these other issues I want to cover. So we'll be covering the issue of abortion and also the issue of punitive or coercive policies against pregnant women who act in ways that we think they should not. And I apologize to, well, I guess, is it just you, Amy? Is Pepe in this class? No. To the people who have me for Repro Ethics, because we're reading some of the same readings right now, so you're going to know these readings inside and out by the time we're done. You might be wondering why I asked you to read the George article. Because it's not a legal article, but what I want to do is highlight a very thoroughgoing ethical analysis of this issue of abortion, whether you agree with it or not. It's a standard conservative analysis of when moral status should attach to preborn life. Then kind of show how that differs so much from legal analysis. You know, with the moral question is really not entirely separate, but quite different from the legal question in this case. So I want to start out doing some discussion of this George article, and then we'll move forward a little bit. And I do like to, for those who haven't had me, I lead class with discussion. I don't like to do a lot of lecturing. So I welcome any and all input from you. So could anyone just briefly describe the analysis of this article and their conclusion in terms of at what point does full moral status attach to the embryo fetus? Yes.
He kind of goes through what he considers to be the pro-life, with quotes explicitly added, arguments for supporting abortion and try and take, says he's taking them down, and toward the end kind of pushes toward chopping off the notion that moral status either grows with the fetus or comes later on, and kind of says if it's ever there, it's always there, therefore this whole thing just has to be off the table.
Exactly. So just to dig a little deeper, how do they respond to the gradualist view, which I think is what many people do have about this issue, like a gradualist view of the moral status of the fetus. As the fetus gets older, its moral status increases, and this is, of course, also reflected in our abortion jurisprudence. After viability, the state can prohibit abortion. What do George and Lee say about that view? Yes, Amy.
They say that basically moral status or personhood doesn't attach to accidental characteristics like consciousness, and it's based on the kind of thing you are. Like, you are a human, which you are from the point of conception.
How did he describe it? A human physiological organism, right? Now, why did he use that terminology? Why didn't he say person, human being? Stephanie?
Well, I get the impression that they're really looking at something beyond what we would consider almost in lay terms to be a person. And so when we say a human being or a person, we think someone who can interact with the outside world, someone we recognize as like us being human. And so I think they're trying to avoid that kind of characterization by avoiding the words we usually associate.
I think that's exactly right. And philosophy as distinct from the layperson discussion, there's a large body of literature that talks about personhood. What constitutes a person? And that personhood then becomes when moral status, what full moral status would attach to an organism, a person. So there's discussion about whether personhood starts with, you know, sentience, with pain. Does it start with full consciousness? Do newborns, some actually argue that newborns are not persons. Therefore, they should have the same moral status. A guy named Michael Tooley has made that argument. Peter Singer has made shades of that argument. So he wants to get around this whole debate about what is a person. They also want to get around the debate of what is a human being. Because while personhood may be more of a narrow definition, you know, many argue that the embryo is a human being from conception. So what does that mean? You know, so that what they want to do is get around that whole debate and say a human physiological organism, which may be the most accurate, the best way to capture that being that they're talking about from their perspective. Any questions about their analysis first before we go on? Comments, opinions? Disagreements, agreements, yes.
Well, I thought it was just interesting when we characterize it as conservative, because I know there's certain strict sects of Orthodox Judaism where up until 30 days after the baby is born, it is still technically not considered a person, or you want to talk about change of personhood. And so that's an example of still conservative, strict
right.
view with respect for life that still takes an opposite approach to this whole idea of personhood. So I think it's interesting, and it makes me wonder which competing ideology here is going to win, or should we even truly be placing more weight on one versus another when there doesn't seem to be. I thought it was interesting. They said they wanted so badly this objective certainty in their voice here in their argument, and I just couldn't help but say, okay, but there's still all these doubts in my mind. So where is your objectivity and where's your perfect certainty?
I completely agree. And you're right. I mean, when I say conservative, that really wasn't accurate. What I meant was because of different traditions that are viewed as conservative, abortion is not a moral wrong. But I guess I'm talking about almost the conservative political view, even though I think most people who are pro-life, in quotes, don't necessarily subscribe to this extreme position, which is abortion would always be wrong, right? Because what is abortion according to this view? It's murder. It's, you know, it's nothing short of murder. Yeah.
Well, and maybe this is a lazy criticism for me to make, but if you're going to take the stance that objectively it is always murder, and you find that you have enough strength behind that argument, it is odd to me that the authors don't bother to mention, like, they very much discount the annoyances of pregnancy rather than really take full on, like, what if the life of the mother is at stake? What if it was the product of rape? Like, why not give that other side the arguments at their full strength? If you really feel that objectively you found the answer, then it, to me, is very disingenuous to say, of course it's murder when countered against the physical pain of labor, which I don't think anyone claims is the appropriate grounds, or, you know, even in the dialogue, that does not tend to be the poster child defense of abortion rights. So I thought that was a weakness of the piece.
Yeah, how do they characterize the burdens on the woman?
It's possibly even less than the life loss of the father in financially, so, like, that part, you know, obviously lost me as a woman, but it's basically a 9-month obligation, and then thanks to the miracle of adoption, that might be where the burden ends, possibly.
My wife just had a baby 2 months ago. She disagreed that it ends
oh.
in 9 months.
That's
yeah. right. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, and we should all thank our mothers, essentially, right? There's a line about, yes, it's burdensome, and for that reason, we should all be very thankful to our mothers. But that doesn't decide the point. Yes, you were going to make.
When they were talking about the voluntariness or lack of, or whether it was voluntary or not to be a part of a pregnancy of sort, it just seemed really outdated too, the way that characterized conception in general, and was not taking into account the more modern scientific or medical procedures that we now have. It was always like there's going to be two people involved, and that's a very intimate thing, and then thus there's an intimate connection also with the fetus inside of the woman, and it's just like, but it was also weird too, because I believe we're both men, right? Yeah, Patrick Klinger. So it's just like very weird how they were ascribing this kind of male-dominated view on the conception process in general, and I felt uncomfortable.
Well, I should give a little background. I don't know much about Patrick Lee, but Robert George, who is a philosopher at Princeton, is very steeped in the natural law tradition, which has much, you know, heritage from the Catholic tradition. So, in the Catholic tradition, you know, it may be immoral to do IVF or other types of procreation that aren't through, quote, natural means. So that's one reason why they don't discuss those issues, I think, so much in here. Though they do have, he does have another article on the extracorporeal status, the moral status of extracorporeal embryos, which essentially says no matter what their location, you know, they are full human beings. So any responses to, now, what is her name again?
Alex, I'm sorry.
Alex. No problem. Yes.
I totally agree. I felt that their sort of voice was rather flippant when discussing how women engage with the fetus and that relationship and the physicality of it. And then at the end they throw in, arguably, men might even have a more intimate relationship with the fetus because they provide them money. And I thought that was just so awful. Like, if they want to make a point, but don't be insulting, you know?
Yeah, maybe I should have not chosen quite such a bothersome piece, but you know, this is the view of quite a few people. Now they may just
sit here and talk about what boneheads they are in portions of their own article.
Right.
They presumably pre-read it after they wrote it and sent it off, and they were like, "We're good with this," and sent it off to a publisher. So if we think that they're being a little bit Neanderthal about some of their approaches, I think that's fair.
Well, let's remember this is a view of the Catholic Church. This isn't a foreign view here.
So the whole thing I was thinking about when reading this is that somebody in here will be able to refresh my memory, but in Autumn's class, we read one article where the author does a thought experiment justifying, she says, even if you believe that a soul is infused at the moment of conception, she does this thought experiment where, you know, yeah, the woman, yeah, the violin
and why
player.
A violinist?
And I get the.
Well,
yeah,
that, yeah, Judith Thompson.
Right, so I don't have to rehash the whole
yeah.
article. But I got the feeling that this is what they're really going after is this, what probably is the view that most Americans hold, which, you know, most pro life Americans would hold, is which is a little more nuanced perspective that says that we accept that under certain circumstances, you know, we may not like it, but there's going to be times where it's necessary. And that's exactly the, I kept thinking that when they're writing this, they have her article in mind that this is what they have to go after.
Well, they directly mentioned her at one point, so they clearly were responding directly to those. When was this written, by the way?
2005, I think.
It's not that, it's pretty recent.
I mean, it reads like something from the 80s.
No, it's like 2005.
Like yeah. I would have looked at the 50s. Like, I feel like we've been here and gotten past this point, and so it's kind of scary that people keep bringing us back over and over again.
It's 2005.
2005. Well, that's when the book was published. I'm not sure when the original article was published, but they respond to Maggie Little. They respond to other people. It's not that old. I mean, did somebody else have their hand up?
I guess,
Jessica.
You know, for me, it was tough to read just because they kind of lost me right out when they completely ignored this kind of gradualist, you know, they act as though anybody would be crazy to think that as, you know, as time progresses, you gain more personhood, and I think that that's so inherent to the way most of us think, whether we think abortion is a good idea or should be legal or not. I think most of us feel that a fetus probably is maybe not the same thing as a person, and so I think for me that, you know, all misogyny aside with the article, I think that was kind of like, well, if you're going to be arguing this, you have to address some of the major concerns for most of the people who are going to be reading this, and for me it kind of left out, you know, it used like the voting, you know, thought experiment, and then like, and that's crazy, and then they go, you know, and then their argument, their rebuttal was kind of crazy. It was like, but you couldn't vote in Switzerland, so I guess for me it was kind of like they didn't address what my concerns as somebody who was pro-choice would be, and so why bother writing the article unless you're writing it to your friends? So,
well, they're really trying to respond, they think, well, to some, I mean, obviously they wouldn't have submitted it for publication, as Stephanie said, to some of the major arguments, you know, on the pro-choice side. I agree, I don't think they do it particularly well. Yes?
Yeah, just in response to that, it was interesting to me to see the terminology that they use for the fetus. So they said the baby, the child.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if mm-hmm. they really are legitimately trying to, you know, speak to the other side of the equation, they shouldn't use words that the other side blatantly doesn't agree with. So I thought that choice was kind of either snarky or just stupid,
mm-hmm.
because the other side is never going to say, yes, that is a child or a baby when it's, you know.
Both sides do that pretty thoroughly in terms of the language that they use, whether you're referring to it as a baby or a product of conception. It's this whole language game that both sides play.
Though fetus is the correct medical term for a child. Child in utero, so a lot of it depends on your stance of how you're viewing that fetus/child as well. Alex,
also word choice when they were talking about, they talked about fullness, complete, and that's important to me because I think it kind of did not leave room for maybe children that would be born with impairments or like fringe cases. Not every baby that is comes to term is a full and complete baby by
mm-hmm.
definition in comparison. So why are we just describing one word? It's not a one size fits all solution here. We're talking about, if we're actually talking about people and human beings, then we need to have room for various forms.
than various degrees.
Though certainly we do accord full moral status to persons with disabilities who are born, so they would argue, you know, is that the point you're getting
at?
Yeah,
no, no, I mean,
yeah.
I totally understand that
yeah.
moral status, but to just once over and say everything is full and complete,
right.
it's not that they're, I understand there's moral status there,
right.
but not,
yeah.
I mean, when they, I think they said, like, everyone is created equal, and unfortunately, I've seen enough people that have disabilities to know that there are certain people that are blessed with more things that are blessed with less things. So it's like, why, they're just trying to like glaze over the
mm-hmm.
issue as in like, oh no, we're right. Everybody's form complete. Their status is there from the beginning, et cetera, game over. It's like, what?
And it is really interesting though to read this article and others like it because, you know, the whole enterprise of ethics is to talk about these ethical questions apart from religion. And, you know, that was the whole project of the Enlightenment. We're going to argue with each other based upon rationality and reasons, not faith, not what God says, not what you said God said, not what they said God said. So we have to give reasons that we all would, our arguments that we all can understand and reason about. And this article really is reflecting a very Catholic point of view without... they're not able to appeal to Catholic doctrine, but in some ways I think that's one reason why I feel so foreign when we read it, because unless you're really steeped in Catholic doctrine, I think this article seems a little...
It's the major unstated first principle under the whole thing.
Right, yeah. Stephanie?
Oh, I read a little bit quickly, so I was trying to go back through and look at how they address miscarriage and other situations where a woman doesn't or can't carry to term. Because, I mean, it almost feels very reminiscent of that scene in Legally Blonde where she's explaining how, you know, a guy wants custody after donating sperm, and then she starts talking about, you know, if donating sperm is what gives you parentage, then anytime you masturbated, it was reckless abandonment. And it's way funnier when you see it on screen, I swear. But that's the cliff notes. But I mean, in this situation, I feel like if you're going to say you're talking about a full human at the point that you have zygote, embryo, not a science person, but when you have your first kind of first contact, then for every time someone has a miscarriage, you're also having maybe not murder, but manslaughter. And that doesn't get addressed.
Depends on the reason for the miscarriage, right?
True. But I mean,
yeah.
You know, If you're responsible for carrying that child to term, and if we as women are, you know, baby machines, basically, which is another reference from a couple years ago, from I think one of the prime ministers of Japan or something talked about women as baby-making machines, and then he was like, no, I didn't mean it like that, and people were going, because that can come out well. But, you know,
at
I
least
mean,
he was frank about it, right?
Yeah.
Was it code?
It's true, yeah. I mean, like, if that's, you know, if that's their role in all this and they're so flippant about what that really entails, then, you know, I would say if you're responsible for a life and something happens to that life, whether or not you meant for it, I mean, if you're talking about a full-on child and something happens and your child dies, you know, we'll sue you for...
Well, yeah, and we're going to get into that more in the next part of the class.
Yeah.
But, John?
So, actually, just one of the things I've always said is that it's not very scientifically derived because... So and it gets to this, you know, with an embryo. I mean, it's very, what I've argued before is that it's a very deterministic view of the embryo, right? Given an embryo, even in a dish, an embryo equals a baby, or an embryo equals a fetus equals a baby. Right? And it's not that case at all. Someplace between 30 and 70% of embryos are discharged harmlessly from the human body before implantation. And then given pregnancy, which means given implantation in the U.S., anybody know what the miscarriage rate is?
1 in 3 or something like that?
70%.
17% from conception or after implantation?
Fetus.
Yeah, because I think it's higher than that if before, if you count
yeah,
conception.
It's 30 to 70%
yeah.
won't implant, depending
right.
on the age of the woman,
right.
the age of sperm, blah blah blah, and the condition of the embryo.
Mm-hmm.
But then once the pregnancy is established, the last big data I saw was 2 or 3 years ago was 17%.
I'm surprised it's not higher actually, but.
Well, it used to be
yeah.
said, and the dogma is 10, 15 years
right.
ago, it's 10%.
Right.
That's actually higher than that.
Yeah.
So this deterministic view, it really doesn't hold.
Well, and I've got a question. question that maybe will reflect how little I understand about certain forms of contraception, but IUDs, does that prevent implantation but not conception?
Right.
So that would be, would an IUD in their case be
yes.
active seeking out abortion every month?
Yes, because if life begins at conception, by the way, you know, the definition of pregnancy is, you know, the medical definition is implantation, not conception. So IUDs, they
so
also
that
think
like
that the pill
passive.
May also,
one of the effects is having
some of the
doctor.
Research they've been doing,
yeah.
it might actually prevent implantation and not conception in certain cases. So those
so
would all be.
Like they would object to all that anyway.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, then they do, but some persons who object to contraception who might think that certain types of contraception are okay would object to the ones where, you know, it's like an abortion. So, but I'm not making sense.
Well, emergency contraception, for instance, emergency contraception the morning after pill,
right.
most of the time it interferes with conception. But there's some chance that it actually will just makes the uterus not a very friendly environment. But supposedly that's only depends when.
Right.
Like 5 to 10% chance or something.
But I wonder too if that's something you would choose to take after engaging in whatever they would probably characterize as irresponsible behavior. And so if that's an active abortion seeking role versus if you get an IUD implanted months before you become sexually active with a partner, you know, is that an ongoing choice to have an abortion or where does intent play in or active passive? I don't know. I just think that breaks down very quickly.
Right. Plus the knowledge of the woman.
Technology.
I mean, you know. But, yeah, there is a debate about various forms of contraception based upon when it acts. But they, of course, would probably be, well, I'm not sure they are, actually, but the Catholic Church, you know, would say no contraception, period, under a natural law type doctrine that is the natural way of the world. But I want to get on to this, the last question on this slide, whoops. Because whether or not you agree that full moral status attaches, you know, at conception or at 6 months, and our debate, our public debate, public discourse about abortion tends to boil down to when does human life begin? And whenever that is, whenever we accord full moral status, then that decides the issue of the morality of abortion. But is that an accurate paradigm? Yes.
I don't think so at all. And that's one of my main arguments when I talk to people about abortion is that we regularly justify doing things that are in a vacuum wrong. You know, using force to solve conflicts is, we consider, a wrong thing to do except in certain situations. Killing people is a wrong thing to do except in certain situations where it's justified. Even if abortion is something we shouldn't be doing, the majority of the time, there can still be situations where it's justified, regardless of what the status of the being that you're working with is. So, it seems like a total red herring, and we'd have a much more productive debate if we moved more on the justification side of things and not the life side of things. But,
and there's a wonderful article that I assign in my Reproethics class by Maggie Little that talks about the morality of abortion, and she really is arguing this is a much more nuanced debate here. Let's leave the law aside. You know, when is abortion moral, when is it not? We tend to talk about whether something's morally permissible. It's permissible in this case, it's not in that case. But it's all context dependent. I mean, every abortion has a story behind it. Some cases we might be bothered if a woman has an abortion when she's, you know, 12 weeks, because we might be bothered about the reasons why she's having an abortion. I think that women aren't generally trusted enough in these decisions, but I'm sure we could all think of some cases where that would be bothersome to us. We might judge her morally. It's not a black or white thing. You know, fetus is viable, it's bad. Pre-viable, it's fine. And it is a much more nuanced type decision. But what is another reason why, you know, when the embryo should be accorded full human status does not decide the abortion question? I mean, there's a very concrete reason here.
Well, I think part of it is that you're looking at it not from the woman's perspective, but actually from
whole other series of arguments you can make, talking about the morality of forcing someone to be pregnant, forcing mm-hmm. someone to carry a child, which actually is probably easier to defend in some respects, because viability is a moving target. And I think court decisions based on viability could be very perilous, could not be defended quite as easily, since viability depends on a lot of different things. And I think if you look at it from a woman's perspective, I think a substantial argument can be made that it's not moral to force someone to have a child.
Right. Location, location, location. You know, if you read some of these articles, you would think that the embryo were created, gestated, and born separately from a woman's body. But it is inside a woman's body. She is gestating it. So her moral status is part of the equation. However, I think in a lot of our debate, you know, that's not something that we tend to see as relevant. It's a, you know, well, even if you say the fetus should be accorded full moral status, you know, you still have the Judith Jarvis Thompson argument or argument similar that you are requiring someone to gestate another human being for 9 months, and to even risk their life, the burdens of pregnancy count. Yeah.
I was going to say, I mean, one, it's actually more dangerous to carry to term than to have an abortion in most developed countries. I mean, you kind of get, it becomes a toss-up the
yes.
less medical care you can attain.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that I don't understand in a lot of these discussions is, I mean, just speaking from a bioethics and law perspective, if we take as a given that, you know, that terminating a pregnancy at any point is murder, then it seems like the immediate jump is to outlaw something, but we've seen over and over the world over that if you outlaw abortion, it does nothing to the rate of abortion. All it does is really make sure that women die trying to have one because they aren't able to get legitimate medical care. So given that, I mean, it's kind of like saying that we outlaw murder because we're trying to prevent murder. And we do outlaw murder because we think it's wrong. We, you know, we are trying to dissuade. But at the end of the day, the things that prevent murder are not the laws that say murder is illegal. It's making sure that people, you know, grow up learning how to interact properly, that they have protection from people that threaten them, and then, you know, dealing with the people who are left who still think murder is acceptable. But I mean, I guess I don't understand how some of these arguments are supposed to translate to law when we've seen over and over, kind of definitively, that just outlawing abortion is not going to have the impact of reducing abortions. So I don't know, that gets me into I'm climbing up my gigantic soapbox about, you know, being against birth control and sex ed and some other things that would potentially limit the number of abortions, since people would not be facing that decision in the first place. But I have a really hard time. Part of my issue with this argument is I have a really hard time seeing how we're supposed to translate that into some kind of policy that makes sense and that actually gets at what they claim the moral issue is. And when you come down to it, if you're looking at it from a woman's point of view, I think you come to very different conclusions. I think if you're really concerned about women and what pregnancy entails, I think it totally changes the direction you go with a lot of these discussions.
Mm-hmm. You know, our murder statutes, almost all our other statutes deal with separate persons who are equal in the eyes of the law. They may be children, they may not have certain rights yet because they're children, but obviously someone who murders a child can be charged with murder, who kills a child can be charged with murder. But is abortion a completely separate case? Is gestation a completely separate case? This is something that Maggie Little argues, that even O'Connor in the Casey case mentions, which we'll get to. Is gestation sui generis, people pronounce it different ways. All of our moral and ethical theory deals with, and this is a critique of ethical theory as well as legal theory, does deal with separate people. But here you do not have separate people. And in fact, you know, do you really have to, you know, what should the medical model be? Some people say you have two patients. Some people argue, well, you really don't have two patients. So, you know, that model of dealing with separate and equal people doesn't fit cleanly into gestation. So the effects of that can be quite profound for in terms of the status of women, in terms of the way we view women, if we outlaw these types of activities.
One of the things that kind of spoke to me was that the in terms of viewing people as separate and distinct entities, was the case of one of the papers, or a couple of the papers talked about, of the guy who sued his cousin because he would not donate bone marrow, which is a pretty, it hurts a little bit, but pretty much like a go in, get the bone marrow, come out procedure. So it certainly does not last 9 months. And even that case, where you have two full grown persons with certain death on the one side for this guy, they did not force this person to do it. So it, when I kind of read about that, I was like, wait, what? And but you're saying that you're going to say that that is, and I think most of us actually probably would see where they're coming from, whether we agree with the decision or not. You could see how, okay, well, this would be an infringement. Yeah, the guy's a total jerk. I can't believe it. But you could see where the legal, you know, thing comes from. But and yet to not apply that to a case in which I'm not sure that everybody agrees that those, you know, a fetus and a mother are equally people in the eyes of the law, it seems like kind of a weird situation where we're taking two totally definitely people and saying, yeah, you can withhold this fairly, this benign treatment, you know, and this guy's certainly going to die. And yet if you're pregnant, you have to go through 9 months, even though we're not even really sure if that person's a person or when it becomes a person and it's a fetus. So that kind of spoke to me about maybe
right,
a little
and
paradox
I think,
there.
Yeah, and I'm going to call on you, but I need to say this while I remember. I think sometimes our reasoning about abortion and about, you know, pregnant women in general has signals really our views about what women's proper roles are or should be. We don't force, in the McFall versus Shimp case, we don't force a separate human being to give bone marrow to a cousin, even a family relationship. Now that is the case of, you know, undergoing medical treatment for the benefit of the other, so that's even enforcing a positive obligation. Though you could say enforcing gestation is as well a positive obligation. But we very readily impose that kind of obligation on women, pregnant women. So I think historically it does have to do, and still have to do with our views of the proper role of women. We're going to go into O'Connor's Casey language because I think it's great language on this issue. Yes.
Well, I think that one of the things I kind of got into here on that particular issue was this distinction between withdrawing and withholding. In that with the bone marrow case, it was withholding like a medical treatment where they see abortion as like withdrawing care from a person. I feel like they're drawing a division there. We talked about this last week that in hospitals, nurses routinely say that is not different. Let's drop that game. So maybe it'd be useful, and you know, if we're trying to liken those two cases, say, well, you know, that thing we're trying to drive between them isn't really there. But I think it seems like that because this, you know, again, it was the notion is a person is in the embryo and aborting is, you know, withdrawing care. It's this active thing versus which
right.
is, you know, morally wrong, where merely like withholding would not be.
Right. I mean, the act of obtaining an abortion is an act, and performing an abortion is an act. You know, the status quo, if that abortion hadn't been done, would likely be, don't know the exact statistics, that child would come, fetus would come to term. So, you know, that is a point to be made. However, should you require another person to carry that child, because then you're also requiring an act, and you're requiring you know, gestation is not a passive endeavor. It's very active, depending on, you know, what you view your obligations to be. But you have a lot of doctor's appointments, you have a lot of physical discomfort or pain, you may develop serious medical complications. It's a very intimate relationship You know, you feel that child move inside you, and that's just, you know, you are, you know, you're not just a receptacle. It's an active endeavor. Hilda Nelson has a great article on this called The Architect and the Bee, talking about how gestation is an active endeavor, and it's an act of intimacy. Alex?
I also think it's dangerous to be in the business of the way we're talking about the physician's role in this, and calling them abortion doctors, or these labels are just not good for the situation. I don't want to live in a society where I go, oh, that's the anti-abortion doctor, and that's the abortion doctor, or that's the one that works with people that have AIDS, or like, I mean, just like, it serves no purpose. If you have a good, cohesive, strong argument, let's stop the labeling and focus a little more on the argument itself. I just don't think it's good to characterize people that way.
And it is code. You know, again, Spark criticizes Kennedy for using the term abortion doctors in the Carhart case. And that is the term used by the pro-life movement, usually, or abortionists. I don't know who had their hand up first. You did, and then you, and somebody else over here as well.
I wanted to bring up the argument about the special responsibility of parents to their children, because I feel like that argument was a little bit harder to get past for me, because I feel like, you know, they were arguing that becoming a parent is not just like a voluntary thing you have to consent to, and that holds a little bit more weight for me, especially when I look at it like from the father's point of view. I don't think a father can just say, well, I didn't consent to being a father, so I have no responsibility for this child, even if it's a born child. And although I disagree with the argument in general, I think that one holds a little bit more weight.
I think you're right. I think this, what you can call the special relationship argument, it's probably the hardest one to overcome. You know, that women, I'm not saying I agree with it, but I'm saying that that is their strongest argument, that you have a relationship with the fetus, you are its, quote, mother, and the fetus is an innocent bystander, and attendant to your role as mother, you have the obligation to carry this fetus to term. Now, Maggie Little, in the article I was talking about before, really talks about how, you know, parenthood isn't just a role, it's a relationship, you know, and certainly your relationship and your special relationship and obligations to your born child are quite different from what they might be with a fetus. You have the role, whether you want it or not, but you don't have a relationship per se, the same kind of relationship you have with other persons. So, and you could argue that, you know, whether you want that role or not is obviously should be relevant. Yes.
Actually, as we're sitting and discussing here, first off, their references in here are as recent as 2003, so it was a pretty recently published article.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, actually now I have a sort of new understanding of their argument, not because I agree with it, because I think that unless you hold the argument that they're making, it does enter in, you know, too much messiness enters into the debate. So you have to get away from that demarcation problem of when does it become a life, and you have to
They think you
right,
have to.
And you have to get away from, you have to be able to ignore then the moral status of the woman if you want to be able to hold their sort of radical position.
Well, I think they would just say, yeah, she has poor moral status, but we don't allow people to murder each other.
Right. You have to, it has to be, you know, so
right.
You have to be able to attribute sort of full, you know, moral, legal rights standing to that, to the unborn child. Otherwise, it all sort of falls apart in the sort of messy situations that we've been discussing.
Which is actually how we think of this, I think. I think a lot of us, our moral intuitions are that there is a gradualist position. We do accord more, you know, moral status to fetus as it ages. Most of us probably are queasy about late-term abortions that aren't performed to save the life or health of the mother. Part of it is a notice issue. The woman has notice. She's had notice for a long time that she's pregnant. If she's going to have an abortion, you know, the argument goes she should get it sooner. But another part of it is, you know, the more the fetus looks like a child, and I'm not saying this is rational, you know, people write books on why this is or is not the case, but I think we intuit that the status of that fetus, as balanced against the woman's agency, starts to take on more weight. I'm going to call on you, and then we have to go to the law because this class is bioethics and law, right? go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say quickly that what you were just talking about, like where certain states are now going to be showing women like a sonogram and
right.
trying to tug at the heartstrings. I mean, I think it just sort of goes back to what you were saying quite a while ago about the trust issue with women, not trusting them to make the right choices. And I believe one or two of the other articles mentioned this, not treating them like thinking, you know, organisms who can decide for themselves, and it's maddening.
Well, I think it does have to do with how we view the sacrifices of motherhood and what we think those should be. And we'll get to that more when we talk about forced cesarean sections and other types of enforced medical treatment on pregnant women, but it certainly comes into play with abortion. That it's selfish to have an abortion. I think we tend to judge people who do, or many people tend to do that, without looking at the individual story behind that abortion. Stephanie?
Okay.
I thought you were going to say
something. I'm just doing my sassy. Yes, I agree.
Okay. Alex?
Real quick, too. I was just thinking about this. It's also interesting, too, because whether right or wrong, the shame associated with abortion limits the way that this discussion can happen in public as well. Because you're not going to have people, like even people that have abortions, there's no one that's like, I'm so pro-abortion, like I want to go get another one. You know, it's not something
right.
that even if you do believe in it, that you then vocalize that belief out loud to many people, unless you have some sort of trust, like, oh, I know that you, like, but it kind of skews the debate in the public because
here, can we pass
you
these
have to
out
talk about it abstractly rather than directly as if you have a real relationship with the problem at hand.
Right. I'm passing out something that I meant to pass out at the beginning of class about some facts on abortion, and I actually need one of those. And just the first section of this, you know, we're talking about the individual stories, the stories behind abortions. I think we have certain stereotypes about who gets an abortion and who doesn't. And if you think about those stereotypes, you don't have to say what your stereotypes might be or what you think other stereotypes might be, but if you look at this who has abortion section, 18% are teenagers. Age 15 to 17 is 6%. I think oftentimes in the media and other places we think that, you know, a lot of underage teens are having abortions, when in fact they make up a minority, quite a small minority. Women in their 20s account for more than half of all abortions. Age 20 to 24, 33%. 25 to 29, 24%. 30% of abortions occur to non-Hispanic black women, 36 to white women, 25% to Hispanic women, and 9% to women of other races. 37% of the women identified themselves as Protestant, 28% Catholic. But the piece of data that I'm most interested in highlighting here, well, there are two of these bullet points, about 61% of abortions are obtained by women who have one or more children. You know, they don't say what percentage of women over age 30 get abortions, but it's not a small percentage. I mean, it's not as if the people getting abortions are teens and early 20s. Most of them already have a child. And the reasons, it's the last bullet point under this section. The reasons women give for having an abortion underscore their understanding of the responsibilities of parenthood and family life. You know, many of them say, I can't have another child. I'm responsible for this child I have now. 3/4 say they can't afford a child. 3/4 say that having a baby would interfere with work, school, or the ability to care for dependents. 1/2 say they don't want to be a single parent or having problems with their husband or partner. It's a complicated question.
Well, yeah. That's, I think when you say things like there's a story behind every abortion and the power of language, like interfere with work is a very diminutive way to refer to,
right.
I will get fired and I will get evicted and I can't afford to put food. And I feel like the language in these surveys, and I don't know what the method
is. And this
are,
is Guttmacher, which is
pro-life, like, even if it's good science,
group,
I think the actual range of what is included under interfere with school or work makes it sound more selfish than it may even be. And that's a frustration for me of in working with
they
women
could say fear losing their job.
Which is really
fear being
out
kicked
of like,
out of school.
I can't afford to live if I don't work.
Right.
Like it gets even more at the fundamental living and not just I like working at this specific job and they don't have a breastfeeding room and it's inconvenient for me.
I don't know if you remember a few years ago there was a commercial for a pro-life group that was going, American families are deciding to make extra room at their table, you know, instead of having abortion. And basically it was showed this family as if all you have to do is pour an extra bowl of Cheerios. Once you have one,
two,
you know,
more.
All you have to do is put an extra chair at the table and then you can easily have the second one. And it was,
right.
You know, utterly ignoring the reality of who was having the abortion.
Right.
That argument that you just said, you could almost turn it into like a pro-life argument. Like I'm so pro my life, pro the lives that I'm already responsible right now that I can't be pro that life. Do you,
right.
I mean, it's, I know that sounds weird. I'm just trying to
think. No, I think that it is a much more complicated picture. You know, you have obligations toward other people in your life already. Having a child sometimes feels not responsible. You know, these are very inflected decisions. Yes.
That was the most troubling thing, I think, for me in all these readings, was the state wants to exercise more control, but yet when the baby's born, there's no pull-through. There's no pull-through mechanism to support the child. So it's like, you've got to have it, but then, oh, by the way, okay, we're done. So
we got to cut Medicaid. Can't have an abortion, then we're going to cut Medicaid.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very common, I mean, a strong objection to some groups within the pro-life movement that while they don't think women should be able to have an abortion, they don't strongly support a social safety net which would enable people to have that child that they didn't want to have. Yes.
I was just going to say the same thing with the financial argument, because a lot of work right now in terms of the word unintended is being done. That it's
mm-hmm.
not that, and again, it goes to sort of research
right.
survey wording, is that there's a ton of work right now. Unintended isn't necessarily what women mean. It's not that it's unintended, it's more of mistimed, which is why you see many women already have children and they're all older.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the financial aspect. If you collapse the categories that are provided on these surveys, 90% of them can fall into that financial category of, it's not that they unintended to have the child, it was what they're now trying to change the word from unintended to mistimed. That
mm-hmm.
it's not that they don't want children, but the financial
right.
impact of having it now.
They don't
like,
want this pregnancy.
Right. So
right
saying
now.
That half are unintended, even, you know, Guttmacher's doing a lot of work right now to say that that's not really
mm-hmm.
what women are saying.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting argument.
Thanks, yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of bothered by the entire discussion, meaning that last time I checked, it was not illegal to be selfish. So even if you put this aside, you know, say you do get an abortion for a selfish reason. Well, guess what? Men do selfish things all the time. And so it turns out to be kind of a women can't be selfish. I don't like your reasons for choosing this. Well, it's not a legal issue. That's a totally different issue. So I feel like, again, it's this kind of demonizing a particular group, you know, whether it's young minorities or, you know, what have you, it demonizes this group, but it's just by necessity female for having characteristics that, guess what, the entire human race has. We can just kind of see the consequences here. Again, I'm not sure that makes a whole lot of sense. We're talking about policy.
Well, but then again, our policy can reflect our, you know, what we think our proper role should be for women, you know, and this is something Ginsburg talks about in Carhartt and O'Connor talks about in Casey, you know, that, you know, historically it has been that women, you know, one of their, what's the, you know, term, you know, the best thing you can do in life is to become a mother, and that's what's going to fulfill you, and if you don't want to become a mother, there's something wrong with you. If you work full-time and have kids, you're selfish. I mean, we make these judgments all the time with women that we don't make with men, because men aren't expected to sacrifice in the same way for their children. They're expected to give them monetary support, and more now they're expected to help with parenting more. But, you know, women's roles, women have been defined by and large by that role of motherhood up until the last, you know, I mean, it's still a problem. It's certainly improved.
I guess the thing that bothers me is, yeah, I know that those things exist. I guess it bothers me that that gets into law, because I would think, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I guess I would hope that people are making laws are not doing it based on, you know, their expectations or their particular prejudice, because I feel like that's what the law protects us from, or is supposed to.
Well, let's get to the law after our hour of ethics discussion. After I've had this hour of ethics discussion, partly on the issue of when the fetus should be given moral status, we turn to legal analysis, which is quite different. Under the Roe and under the abortion jurisprudence cases, Roe, Casey, Stenberg versus Carhartt, Gonzalez versus Carhartt, the issue is not when human life begins, though certainly the courts look at that, but they essentially have to look at the Constitution. The Constitution does not define person as a fetus. So one of the central holdings of Roe, which has been carried on through later cases, is the fetus is not a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment. However, there's an interesting statement right after that in Roe, which I just kind of noticed for the first time. not for the first time, but I haven't read the case in a while. The appellee argues that the fetus is a person. This is the people who are arguing against, I mean, defending the law in Roe. Argued that the fetus is a person within the language and meaning of the 14th Amendment. If this suggestion of personhood is established, the appellant's case, of course, collapses. For the fetus's right to life is guaranteed specifically by that amendment. So they're simply saying, if the fetus is a person, of course abortion should be illegal.
But isn't the 14th Amendment only against state action?
Right. But they're saying that that decides the case.
But it wasn't state action that was causing the abortion. State action was preventing it.
Right, but they're saying that if we decided that that the fetus is a person, then the state can prohibit abortion from day one, because that decides it, whether the fetus is a person or not.
Fetal personhood laws suddenly make a lot more sense.
Excuse me?
I said fetal personhood laws that are being put up for ballots all over the place now make a lot more sense. I mean, if you can say,
right,
if you could have a whole bunch of people vote and say, we've decided the fetus is a person, then
which they can't really do constitutionally. I mean, they can voice their opinion, but yeah.
They could pass a state constitutional amendment. They could do a federal constitutional amendment as well.
Right. Right, they would have to have a federal constitutional amendment for those laws to be constitutional, because right now under Roe and Casey, they're not going to be able to put the fetal rights above the woman's, at least up until the time of viability.
You can see kind of what they're getting at when they have these huge pushes, because they can get enough states to say the people want to amend, like I think Colorado was trying to get its constitution amended for this exact kind of language, and people were concerned because they're saying, you know, there's a lot logistically that they hadn't covered. If you make a fetus a person from the point of conception, there are all manner of things, including birth control, that, you know,
right,
as you were saying earlier, get really messy,
right,
really quickly from a legal perspective.
Right, and you know, this really is a very simplistic way of looking at it, because of course the mother does have some rights, you know, and is a person under the 14th Amendment. It's a perfect example of how general legal analysis and ethical analysis really has to do with separate and distinct entities and not gestation. So now this is dicta, so, you know, not sure they would actually find that, but I thought it was an interesting point that they made. Okay, I just have already talked about this. So the Roe, what were the central holdings of the Roe case? Somebody want to offer that? Just the framework. We don't have to get too complicated.
Amy. Well, the state's interest in the preservation of fetal life only becomes compelling at the point of viability. And so after the point of viability, they can prohibit abortion.
And what was the right enunciated that protected the woman's right to have an abortion?
Privacy.
Right, so they hinged the Roe finding on the right to privacy, which is quite controversial. Justice Blackmun used to be general counsel at the Mayo Clinic, and he was very interested in medical issues, physician-patient relationship issues. He studied this case, you know, the historical, the history of abortion and the data and everything quite carefully before he wrote this opinion. And he did hinge it upon the right to privacy. And the language of Roe is quite interesting because while, of course, it is a watershed decision for women who support abortion, for those who support abortion, the language really is when we read it now, seems quite dated. Because one of the essential findings is for the stage prior to end of the first trimester, the abortion decision and its effectuation must be left to the medical judgment of the pregnant woman's attending physician. And if you read the Roe case, it really does almost read as if he's describing a physician's right to make this decision versus a woman's right to make the decision. Are you going to say
crazy? Something?
Excuse me?
I said, well, let's not get crazy. I mean, we're going to give someone's decision. It's got to be the doctors.
Right, and you know, it reflects the times. Maybe he also did it for pragmatic reasons. He didn't want this to sound too radical. I don't really know the answer to that question.
And it may also have been helpful that in the early 70s, I would assume most doctors making this decision would have been men. So it's kind of a decision passed from one group of men to another, which had to have been more comfortable for a lot of justices, I would think.
It was also in the nascent days of informed consent. Very few informed consent decisions by 72.
Right. So Roe essentially held what Amy has, as Amy has described, the compelling state interest begins at viability. Up until that time, it's the woman's right to have an abortion. It also established, very importantly, the health and life exception to state regulation of abortion. In the last trimester, or after viability, the state may not prohibit abortion if the life or health of the woman is at stake. Then there were not many Supreme Court abortion cases that were of real import. There were a few, I guess, before Casey.
Webster was fairly.
Yeah. But Casey then was, well, I guess Casey was the first decision that came along where they thought they might reverse Roe, because there were changes on the Supreme Court that indicated that that may very well be the case. But Casey did uphold the essential holding of Roe, as they described it. However, O'Connor, who wrote the decision, used language that was much more attuned to the woman's interests at stake. She described the right to abortion as a liberty interest, not a right to privacy. The court has been moving away from its privacy analysis and really going more into liberty analysis, what they call a substantive due process analysis under the 14th Amendment. And her, the language in the Casey case, I think, is really very, well, a lot of people have complained about Casey because it did throw out the trimester framework, and importantly, it did justify certain regulations of abortion even from the very beginning. At the same time, I think the language of Casey is much more in tune with feminist analysis of this case, of this situation. I'm trying to find now my page that I want. Sorry, I should have highlighted this before I came in. There's a paragraph in here. Here it is. I did highlight. On page 910, and I know I gave this to you guys yesterday. You don't have to read. You didn't have to read it. Only if you wanted to. I forgot to assign a case, but I forgot to assign this case. I'll read it. Men and women of good conscience can disagree, and we suppose some always shall disagree about the profound moral and spiritual implications of terminating a pregnancy. Some of us as individuals find abortion offensive to our most basic principles of morality, but that cannot control our decision. In other words, there's a lot of moral disagreement out there, but we're deciding on the Constitution. This is a plural, a society of plural opinions. It's a plurality. We have a lot of deep moral disagreements, but therefore we need to respect the right to choose. In some cases, our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code. And then there's language that's really interesting. Abortion is a unique act. It is an act fraught with consequences for others, for the woman who must live with the implications of her decision, for the persons who perform and assist in the procedure, for the spouse, family, and society, which must confront the knowledge that these procedures exist. Though abortion is conduct, it does not follow that the state is entitled to prescribe it in all instances. And here's a strong language. That is because the liberty of the woman is at stake in a sense unique to the human condition and so unique to the law. The mother who carries a child of full term is subject to anxieties, to physical constraints, to pain that only she must bear. That these sacrifices have from the beginning of the human race been endured by women with a pride that ennobles her in the eyes of others and gives to the infant a bond of love cannot alone be grounds for the state to insist that she make that sacrifice. You know, so we may have these very noble ideas about women's role as mother, but that is not grounds to prohibit abortion. Her suffering is too intimate and personal for the state to insist without more upon its own vision of the woman's role, however dominant that vision has been in the course of our history and our culture. The destiny of the woman must be shaped to a large extent on her own conception of her spiritual imperatives and her place in society. So surely getting at, you know, the deep underlying issue here of what's at stake for the woman, much better than the Roe court did, much better than any other cases before this case did. I think that's a very important point to make about Casey. Any questions about that before we?
I just have a question. Does this one also have the viability clause in that? I'm trying to understand why you could have this liberty issue or even a privacy issue, and then what viability would have to do with that, especially in the setting of, you know, medical advances that change that. Like, why does my liberty get curtailed now at, you know, 24? 4 weeks if it used to be 28 weeks. I'm just trying to figure out how the.
Well, that's a question. You know, some people have said that the Supreme Court's abortion jurisprudence is on a collision course with itself. I'm not sure that's going to happen, though, because I don't think, do you think we're going to take viability much before 23, 24 weeks? I mean,
not anytime soon.
After all
I'm
this time.
To,
but
yeah.
Even if you do, what is that?
Yeah.
Even
what
does that,
have
what
to
is
do
that
with
still,
my liberty
right,
or
exactly.
My privacy,
you're,
right?
To me, these are two different things. I mean, I don't come from a legal background, so I'm thinking about this, just this demarcation problem that they're that this would hinge on that doesn't quite make sense to me. And even 20 weeks is viable, and I read all the horrible data when my wife was pregnant about what, you know, when we hit a safety zone and stuff like that, and even at 20 weeks,
you're not viable.
It's not
between,
arbitrary, but
right.
It smells arbitrary to me. I mean,
and morbidity and mortality, I mean, you'd argue that somebody, a child who suffers through so much morbidity, I mean, yeah, they're viable, but at you know, say a certain point, 100% have morbidity associated with them.
Right.
And it's not like if I don't get the, I don't understand, are they implying that they would harvest the baby and put them in.
Well, you're right. That's
support.
Always been
I
a contention with Blackmun's initial framework of viability. So what if it's viable? It's not out of the woman's body.
Yeah,
so
exactly. You're not going to take
it. It's like
it
you're
out,
suddenly attributing them a set of rights that they otherwise, up to 20 weeks, they don't. But now you're suddenly giving them this set of legal rights that I don't think.
Well, I think what he was trying to get at was once it's viable, once it could live outside of the woman's body, even though it doesn't. It's a person. It should be accorded full human rights, you know, because that's just because it could live independently. The fact that it doesn't wasn't really relevant to his the reason why he was using viability. John.
So maybe I can just kind of step back a little bit. So interesting that abortion at common law, if you go back 200 years, abortion was legal everywhere worldwide. And the first place that it became illegal for any time was in England. In England, which meant if England banned something, it basically covered half the world. So England, and it was the church, and England basically banned abortion post quickening. And quickening was this magic moment when women could feel movement someplace.
So that's going to be around 4 months or so.
Okay, is it that late?
Yeah.
And it's pretty subjective. You feel anything? I don't know. And what they used to call it, they called the procedures, was like returning the menses, or you know, somebody locked up and you can kind of do these procedures to kind of get make the woman healthy again. And so the British basically banned it.
Because remember, they didn't have ultrasounds. They didn't really even know what was going on inside before quickening.
It was female dominated. I mean, midwives were who you went to. You didn't go to doctors.
Right.
For that kind of
So, but it was like the theme that we had last week was technology kind of drove it.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, in some sense, we did, because of the stethoscope and stuff like that, now you could also hear a heartbeat and stuff. So technology did lean on it. And anyway, so that was in 1803. In 1828, Connecticut was the first state in the United States to ban abortions for all reasons. And the last place was in 1901, the District of Columbia became the last district to ban abortions for all reasons. And the movement in the middle 1800s was driven by two things. It was the church, and it was organized medicine. So the people that were, it was the midwives that were doing abortions and stuff like that, and they were pushing abortifacients, and they were kind of like, they had services that they would deliver. And the regular doctors, known as now as the American Medical Association, basically wanted to push them out. So what they do, they kind of used the power of their purse, and they went to the legislatures, and they got these laws passed. There was also, at the late 1800s, but when this is happening, they also had the Victorian kind of moral time. They had a guy named Comstock. You've probably heard of Comstock. He was a big anti-contraception guy in the federal government. He was a sleazeball and other anyway. By 1901, we had all these laws. And it was interesting, because basically the arguments by the AMA was that abortion is dangerous, right? And then the Soviet Union first legalized abortion, then Japan wound up legalizing abortion in the 1920s. And through the war, some states around the world legalized abortion. It became very clear very quickly that it was very safe. Nonetheless, the arguments continued. And in fact, in the 30s and 40s, there was a big movement by district attorneys, prosecutors, to basically go after doctors who were performing abortions. The early good evidence is that there were about 1 million abortions being performed a year across the United States by the mid-1900s. And they were pretty dangerous. And what happened, there was really good evidence. There was a paper, I think, if anybody's interested in it, that showed that when you went after the doctors and you threw the doctors in jail, like in Massachusetts, the female, the maternal mortality increased. Maybe it's because they now were, instead of going to the doctors, they were going to the back alley and they were getting sepsis and dying. And this was just kind of accepted. You know, it was just kind of, everybody kind of knew it went on. People, I grew up in New York, and it's like everybody knew where to go, who the doctors were that performed abortions. I had a friend whose mom had, I mean, she told me, her mom back in the 50s, she was a model, and she didn't want to have babies yet. She had two abortions, and they knew the doctors to go to. If you had money, you knew where to go. If you didn't have money, you went up in the back alley, and then in the hospital. So we talked about model penal codes and model statutes. In the late 50s, there was a movement by I guess it wasn't called the uniform state law thing yet, but there was a model penal code that was promulgated, and a guy named Alan Guttmacher was the physician behind this law, right? And it was adopted, and basically it was trying to broaden the conditions under which abortions could be done. So it was for maternal health and risk mm-hmm. to the mom. It was for fetal indications, if the fetus had serious defects, and it was rape, and it was incest, and it was for girls. Interestingly, one of the presumptions of valid abortion was for girls under the age of 16, I think, or 15. That was a condition justifying abortion. Anyway, Mississippi in 1966, I mentioned this last week, Mississippi actually adopted a law because it was a rape case. Kind of a hard case in Mississippi, a woman who was raped, and Mississippi's legislature actually adopted a law in 66 saying abortion cases of rape is okay. And then starting in Colorado in 67, about a dozen states
started to liberalize.
70 started to adopt this model penal code. And it didn't make it illegal for all purposes, but if you met these certain conditions, and also they started creating in 67, they started creating the medical boards. So you get three white male doctors who basically look at your case. If you're a rich white girl, you get an abortion. They'll approve your abortion. Anybody else, forget about it. And if you're a friend of the docs, you get it. But otherwise, forget about it.
Or if you're a white woman raped by a black man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's
so
probably
that,
the basis
was,
for the Mississippi exemption.
So then, and people then were kind of marching into court, and there was a lot of else happening in the late 60s because this was really an empowerment time. And there were women organizations that were basically taking women, and they were learning. In fact, the women actually learned, it was in California, they learned how to perform abortions, they were performing them. There was a group of ministers that was taking women for abortion.
Mm-hmm.
When abortion became legal in New York in 1970 by statute, and then in Washington, then again in California, when California's 67 law was held to be unconstitutional by the California Supreme Court, they adopted a broadening law in 71, I believe. And so there was this general trend to kind of like make it legal in places. And when it was legal in Chicago and in New York and stuff, there were transportation services set up to kind of bring women to those places, right? And then Roe hit. And Roe just kind of like threw everything in helter-skelter, you know, in some sense.
You know, I just went to an abortion conference last fall at Princeton. Frances Kissling, who's a visiting scholar here, helped organize. And it was really, it was about trying to find common ground between pro-life and pro-choice groups, and there were people from both sides there. It was very interesting, just from that perspective. But I saw a panel that was on the issue of whether abortion should be a constitutional issue or whether it should be left up to the states. And Peter Singer said he thought it should be left up to the states. Robin West, who's a very preeminent feminist legal scholar, argues it should be left up to the states. So really, you know, this division of, well, you know, if you're pro-choice, you automatically think that it should be a constitutional right, versus if you're pro-life, you think it should be left up to the states. Is not accurate. I mean, there are some people who believe, you know, that the states, obviously many states would legalize abortion, some states would make it illegal. The issue is whether you really feel like it's such a fundamental right that women should have to travel, pay money, it's too much of a hardship, you know, to have to go to another state to have an abortion. So from that perspective, it's not at all a good solution, but go ahead.
Can I make one last comment? So historically, abortion was termination of pregnancy and other than live birth. So viability becomes like a very critical moment because, I mean, the old abortion was you induce labor. In fact, they still do that. If late term stuff, they induce labor, right? And the baby would come out and if it survives, it was a birth, and it didn't survive, it was a in some sense, the science of it, I mean, the limitations of technical and medical skill was that we were, you know, that's our intervention here. We know how to kind of get to that point. But we're not inducing abortion. So this idea of a post-viability abortion is meaningless. And I'm willing to fight about that. But it's, because you have to ask, and this is where the partial birth thing, which we'll talk about, I guess, the partial birth thing comes in. Because if you take a 26-week fetus and you kill it in utero or partially in utero, what is it? Is that something that you should want to be done? I mean, is that somehow different legally and morally than at 22 weeks?
Well, that's a good question. I think legally and morally we might have different answers. But you know what? I have to take a quick break and then we'll come back. And I'm trying to figure out what we're going to cover because I haven't gone near fast enough here.
Take 5 or 6 minutes?
Yeah, let's take 5-6 minutes. Okay.
Adapt my
Family Guy where Stewie goes in and almost makes sure. It's pretty epic.
Sorry.
This stuff just drives me. So
yeah, I'm more interested in what I was thinking about in terms of what the implications and
if you could find a policy, some kind of governmental policy that is predicated on how to do
it. What it does do is ensure that
they're because one of the things that happens in making policy is
the regularity, like to the point that it's one of the major causes of death.
And it's always
interesting.
I mean, the other thing, of course, I'm interested in is involuntary medical statutes. Most of our state banks are, the SAC streets, especially in Pennsylvania one, they're all in the state's room. Doing, and I think that those are interesting also, so I'm going to look at that instead of what they do.
But I don't take care of anyone who's the other way.
Clearly,
I'm culture of death, Darren.
I would clobber pretty much anyone
would be very
cross.
They're the same parties. What are the arguments they're making about? Did they bring in evidence about how organs is working? And how do they make the arguments about?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that would be.
I think if you have a pen card, you can go to the law library.
Okay.
And you can ask,
and they don't need
say, as a law student who recently had a friend who had to deal with a flasher, they let anybody in. So,
but I'm not a flasher though.
No, you don't have to be a flasher, but it helps. No, seriously, just walk in like you know what you're doing, and if you have a pen card or anything that looks like a pen card, you can probably have a Blockbuster pen card and get into the pen library. Because once you're in the building, they let you go wherever you want
to
go.
And even with ID, as long as you have ID, you can sign in as a visitor to any of the libraries.
True. Yeah,
so
even if you don't have ID, so
yeah,
it's pretty much.
Just
and then what you were saying about the parties involved, how would I find out?
So some of it is applying the statute, finding the statute itself in the Washington Code should be fairly straightforward. And then it should give some reference to some background materials. There should be some extent. You may have done some phone calls. You may talk to the research library. If that doesn't work, then I can try to help you. Talk to the library.
Yeah.
They should be able to get you the sources.
I'm just used to there being like clear references, and I start on a hunt and I go there, and then I look at those references.
Well,
there.
It is. Just that it is, but actually, with the statutory records, and legislative history stuff, and within the states, I'm not even here, how much is there? It's probably evolved over time. Do you ever do any statutory? Have you ever looked into kind of like state legislative histories?
Oh, yeah.
It
exists. You can find a lot of them on Westlaw and Lexis. They have, it depends on the state too. Like, I once had to do a kind of a review of all 50 states for certain kinds of laws, and you start going through, and Lexis apparently negotiates with each state, and sometimes you have a license and sometimes you don't under Penn's agreement.
This is like a search engine?
Yeah, it's a legal search engine that like any of the reference folks at the law library can show you, but it's also, a lot of them, surprising amount, actually keep it online, just like if you Google. And the only problem is that compared to like a Westlaw search engine, they actually have people that are employed to make sure everything's up to date, which would be the only real difference. But I'm actually surprised at how much you can get. If you go to some of the State Department websites, they'll have whatever laws apply to what they do, which is really, it's kind of nice that in the internet age, people actually have access to some of this, because before it was just, you had to have a law degree, basically, to access some of that, so.
And on the federal level was Thomas, the LLC, the Library of Congress, .gov, and you actually search by bill name or number or something like that, and you can find everything about them. It's current, I don't know how far back that goes or anything.
I think there's a link to that on the main library's website.
There's also a really nice new one, I think it's called Open. But like Open Congress, I don't know how far back it goes, but I know for the Healthcare Reform Act, the entire thing is there, and it's on a website, so you can do like Control F to find
stuff. So that's like federal stuff?
Pardon?
Yeah, that's federal stuff?
Yeah.
And so I have to say, someone really like to make a gigantic deal at the top. So I think really hard to find stuff.
May not be. Which one is that? Might not have enough of these. Probably do.
Oh, is there?
Nice. I'm just giving you some handouts from the Guttmacher Institute with some facts on abortion and substance abuse during pregnancy. Oh, and here's a summary of the Pennsylvania abortion statute. Pennsylvania abortion statute was, part of it was the basis for the Casey case. Casey struck the spousal notification provision, but it's still in the statute, so that if Casey is struck, it'll be on the books. Some states are starting to prepare for the possibility of Roe Casey being overturned, and have started to draft laws that would be in place, pro or anti regulation. Anyway, I'm trying to, since we're kind of limited on time, I'm going to go through these abortion slides real fast, because I really want to get to the issue of pregnant women and abortusarians, drug prosecutions. So in the Casey case, the challenge provisions were an informed consent provision and 24-hour waiting period. A minor was required to get consent from a parent with judicial bypass. Unless certain exceptions were met, a woman must sign a statement saying she notified her husband. All of these were upheld except for the last provision. And Casey held, these are the essential parts of the holding, that the state has a profound interest in potential life throughout pregnancy. However, it may not impose an undue burden on the woman's ability to obtain an abortion. Pre-viability. An undue burden exists If its purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman that should be seeking an abortion before fetal viability. So it's essentially a purpose or effect placing a substantial obstacle. Now, what that means was then left up to the courts, you know, district courts, appellate courts. It's kind of a case-by-case issue. I handed out an overview of abortion laws brief that highlights some of the restrictions that are imposed in different states. There's a chart at the back, so I'm not going to go over all the different restrictions, but this is a good resource if you want to look at that, look for that information. And then, of course, it reaffirmed Roe. The state can prescribe abortion after fetal viability, except where necessary, and appropriate medical judgment for the preservation of the life or health of the mother. Life or health exception then remained in the law and, you know, is for obvious reasons very important. But this was, you know, then one of the major focuses on in the Carhart decision, which came after Casey. So since Casey, there have been various narrow restrictions, gestational limits, of course. Some states, many states, require that abortion be performed by a physician. They may mandate counseling. Waiting periods are very common. Many states require some kind of parental involvement, but then again, you have to have a judicial bypass under certain circumstances.
So
yes.
I've never heard of this one before, and I'd love some of the med students or doctors' opinion on the third to the last, the state-mandated counseling. I feel like doctors aren't even legally required to counsel on the link of things like birth control and breast cancer, and it says here that 6 states require doctors to counsel the purported link between abortion and breast cancer. I feel like as a medical professional, if I didn't find that research compelling, I would be very offended by a law that required me to tell a patient, by the way, there's studies that I don't agree with, that I find illegitimate, but they say that if you do this thing that you're asking me for, you might get breast cancer.
But you could actually still counsel because it's the purported link, and you could say, some people think there is, the studies show there is not. I mean, that would be, I don't know if maybe there, I think it would
you could
depend
even
on
say,
what the law says.
The law requires me to tell you
yes.
that I think that, you know,
okay.
that there may be a link, but I disagree, and the data shows
lobby,
there's not.
Like, when those kind of laws come to the books, is there typically a strong response from not even libertarian doctors, just like moderate doctors who feel that that's micromanaging, or is they
ACOG.
Tend to stay
yeah,
quiet?
I was
going to
say the ACOG
group
probably does.
ACOG responds very strongly in the Carhart decision, which we're going to cover, which has to do with prohibiting a type of abortion. The medical profession ACOG was very, the American, now it's called Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Which is essentially the group of, you know, OBGYN's national group, has come out very strongly against. I mean, they always file briefs. They argue that this is a bad policy.
But then they turn around in the actual decisions and just call them abortion doctors, which kind of, I mean,
yeah.
is a real, I think, slap in the face to any professional who happens to, you know, be making these statements at the risk of their own safety in a lot of cases.
But it was also an England case with the ACOG and the partial birth thing. The ENX, the AMA came out supportive of it. The AMA was also sucking up to Congress, to use my vernacular, for other benefits. The AMA is extremely political and can be bought.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think that any physician really looks to the AMA as representing them. It's a very interesting. I'm not a member. I'm a member of the internal medicine group. Their purpose is just so political, we don't really think about them as shaping policy for what an actual doctor would do. They're more like an interest group for doctors.
Well, they're an interest group with a voice on the Hill, for sure. And most doctors don't belong to the AMA, but maybe you should join because they're listened to, whether it's a valid voice or not. they tend to be more conservative than a lot of the other groups, such as, you know, the Internal Medicine Group, ACOG, all the, you know, American College of Cardiology. I mean, they all kind of step in only when it has to do with their type of medicine, but AMA, you know, steps in quite often. But yeah, I think probably their largest activity is protecting reimbursement levels.
They're more protective of physicians. I don't really think about, I was trying to explain this to my husband, like, why I was a member. I was like, well, I don't need to protect my own interests. My goal as a physician is to protect the interests of my patient, which is what these specialty groups are.
Right. Well, and to even interfere further with the provider-patient relationship, some states are now requiring not only that an ultrasound be performed, but that the woman actually view it. Oklahoma now has a statute to that effect. You know, these statutes, not all these restrictions have made it to the Supreme Court. In fact, most of them haven't. But the question is, you know, does this impose a substantial burden, making someone view an ultrasound? I mean, you could say that most restrictions would not impose a substantial burden. I mean, depends on how you define substantial burden. What's the exact phrasing? Undue burden, substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion.
Even within Casey, though, when they go through, they say undue burden, they articulate what that is, and then they go back and say the following restrictions are fine. I mean, imposing a 24-hour wait period on someone who may be living far away from providers, et cetera, to me is a clear undue burden. So I think when they, you know, they defined it, but then when they actually apply it, they've already taken most of the teeth out of that term.
Well, they did leave it open, right? They left it open to a factual finding. It was remanded for factual findings on those issues.
Yeah, but
that's,
you know,
a little different than saying
disparate,
you know,
impact based upon income level is completely irrelevant from their perspective. They've already found that, you know, Medicaid does not have to cover abortions, period. And that was upheld. I mean, you know, that rule was upheld by the Supreme Court.
Hyde Amendment.
So, excuse me?
The Hyde Amendment?
The original restriction was
different amendment. I mean, different issue. The Hyde Amendment says no federal funds can be used for abortion.
Right.
The Medicaid issue was whether women, it was really a positive versus negative right issue. Well, do women have a positive right to federal funding for abortion in certain circumstances? And they said no. So, you know, these are very complicated questions, which they don't always get the, you know, think through the effects of their findings, but some of them on the court would argue that's not their job. You know, certainly the strict constructionists would say, well, abortion shouldn't even be here. You know, it wasn't in the Constitution, it's not mentioned. Why are we deciding abortion cases? That's Scalia and Thomas, both of them.
Sorry, this might be backtracking a little bit, but I just wanted to clarify. After the point of viability under Roe, the fetus still doesn't have any rights. Like, it's still not a person under the Constitution. It's just that the state's interest in the
state's
fetus
interest
becomes compelling.
So, now, after, that's no longer the framework, though. That was Roe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the state's interest, they don't use compelling. Do they still use compelling wording? I guess they do, but it has a substantial interest, a profound interest throughout pregnancy. But after viability, it can't prohibit,
right,
except under the life or health exceptions.
So it's just that the state has a compelling interest and so can make a law prohibiting abortion. But I keep thinking about, like, the whole thing, if someone murders a pregnant woman, like, would that...
Those
that's
are
still not covered.
Statutes.
Like, even if it's in the third trimester, it's still not a person, so it's not.
Well, some states
crime.
Have said, and
right,
that's been upheld, because you could say that murder from a third. The issue is whether you're going to charge a woman with murder or a third party with murder, for murdering the woman. So she murders, you murder the fetus and the woman, and some states find that that's murder.
Lacey Peterson.
Excuse me.
Wasn't that the case in Lacey Peterson? California,
Did they charge him with?
Yeah,
yeah,
with both.
With two counts.
So, but what is the actual, like, legal justification? Because it's under the Constitution, it's still not a person with rights, right?
It's not a person with rights that are constitutionally protected, but the state can, in its own criminal code, say, I mean, I'm not sure that you could strike that based upon the abortion cases, because there, it's not the situation
so
of gestation.
The state has to have a separate law about that?
Yeah. Yeah, they would have to pass a separate law, though now they're starting, you know, they're trying, or they, cases have been brought where they tried to include the fetus as under their the child abuse statutes, so that, you know, if the fetus is harmed, then that's child endangerment under the child abuse statutes.
Mm-hmm.
Every case, every court that's looked at that, except for the Supreme Court of South Carolina, has found that that is not legitimate. and then if a state did specifically amend their statute to find a fetus, then the issue would be whether the woman could be charged with that because of the gestational relationship. It's a little separate from the murder
mm-hmm.
By a third party. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated. I don't really know how it would work there. But.
Yeah, I'm just trying to wrap my head around
it. The statutes do accept. They accept out the mom and the doctor with consent for the abortion.
Yeah.
Is if the abortion laws, if they then later got rid of their abortion laws, they actually might, I mean, one of the problems is, as I've always argued, is that because of Roe, we've kind of like made things so hypersensitive here, that the post-Roe period, when Roe is finally overruled, which depends on how presidential politics go, the regulatory environment will be much stricter than it was before Roe. So you'll have
yeah.
laws, you'll have states preventing
right.
people from traveling to other states. You'll have a residency requirement.
Which probably is a constitution.
I hope not.
Because it interferes with
interstate
travel. But
right, but we had a case some years ago in Pennsylvania
yeah. Yeah.
where a mom took her boyfriend's minor's girlfriend
mm-hmm.
to New York for an abortion, and she was charged. And I think she was convicted and settled again and did public service or something like that, instead of challenging it on constitutional ground. That she was not the girl's mom. That the thing was,
right.
There was another case where they charged somebody's mother. There was a statute. There was, in fact, there was a federal statute. There was a statute that said that restricted who could take somebody to a different state. And
a
it was broad
statute?
Enough. Maybe it was
for an abortion.
It was Pennsylvania's even, but it was broad
yeah.
enough that would prevent grandma from taking the granddaughter. And that's serious. So minors. I mean, one of the things that we've also known since post-Roe is that the poor and the minors are the ones who get the regulation. So we have the minor, you know, the parental.
Right.
Involvement statutes, and we have the restrictions on payment.
The waiting periods, you know, women of means are generally going to be, well, I mean, they could travel to another state if they want.
Go home,
you know.
They used to.
When you're
yeah.
talking about the regulation would become, I mean, likely more strict because there would have essentially been a definitive rejection of Roe, then would that also apply to just adult women who are crossing state lines for a particular?
Well, I think that would run into constitutional problems.
Yeah.
But, you know, they could do kinds of things. I mean, at one point...
They
yes.
have. I mean, since when he said Roe was over, I mean...
I'm
Casey. Casey has allowed a lot more restrictions to be put in place. It's permissible under Casey to have these 24-hour waiting periods and other restrictions.
But isn't Roe still a kind of a law of the land? I mean, Casey was a plurality opinion. Meaning there were three judges who kind of like said... You know, this is what we think, but this with what you've been talking about, the Connor's opinion. And there were two judges who kind of like said that, you know, they think Roe is the law of land, settled that way, and then of course the right wing people have just kind of like toss it.
Well, but there was a majority in the majority.
Right.
That yeah.
was 3-2.
Yeah.
So it was.
But it's I mean Casey is seen as the controlling precedent.
I think both go together.
Right.
So if they made the residency restriction, that would be you couldn't travel, right? Because it would be like physician-assisted suicide in Oregon, you have to be a resident.
Yes, but Pennsylvania, see, what the thing is, that all of the statutes that have been adopted by the states are trying to restrict. They're not going to, Pennsylvania would make it illegal immediately, right? Or some years ago, in fact, a number of states passed laws that said, this is not taking effect, but if Roe
the case
here
overturned.
Now, I like Utah. Utah actually created a foundation accepting donations to uphold. It was actually, they passed this really illegal, unconstitutional statute, totally restricting abortions, and then said, we recognize this isn't enforceable, and we are creating a foundation to take private donations to support the law in court. Basically, so you're not going to use our own state dollars to kind of like do the legal battle here, but we take personal private donations to do it.
It's becoming less and less important almost, because if you start putting restrictions, it becomes just sort of a skeleton. It doesn't really hold anything any longer. So I think that's the pro-life attitude, is to, we're not going to overturn Roe. It's not, they'll never make it through the blue states overturning Roe, but what we can do is work out of this way. It's a different approach.
Well, right. I mean, I think that they will continue to try to overturn Roe when the time is right. Right now, it's 5-4. Kennedy surprised everyone and joined the pro-choice side in Casey. However, he did write the opinion in Gonzalez versus Carhart, which I want to discuss briefly. This was a quite interesting case, upholding the federal law that banned, partial birth abortions. Previous to this case in 2000, the court had struck Nebraska's partial birth abortion law because, number one, it found that several of the, I can post these slides, by the way, several of the, that it was vague and that the prohibition could actually apply to the common dilation evacuation procedures performed in the second trimester. Also, it didn't contain a health exception. Then Congress passed a very similar law. Questionable whether, did they actually have jurisdiction to pass this law? The strict constructionists on the court probably should find that it's not allowed under the Commerce Clause. But, because there really aren't many federal laws on abortion. Abortion is really more of a state-by-state matter. So Congress's law did not include a health exception. However, it did define the abortions that were prohibited a little more specifically, as to take away the vagueness issue. Kennedy wrote the majority opinion on this, upholding the federal partial birth abortion law. And this decision has been very unpopular among the medical profession and others, because essentially it did say that Congress can decide itself whether this type of law would ever be necessary for the health of the woman. They got around the health exception by saying Congress found that there isn't a health exception. This is never necessary to protect the health of the mother, this type of abortion.
That's true. She can, and you know why?
Excuse me?
Because she can go through a hysterotomy, she can go through basically major surgery instead.
Well, or they said that you could give some kind of injection
induced labor.
Right. So you know, ACOG had filed a brief, and other groups, other medical groups, had filed briefs saying this may be necessary in certain circumstances. But essentially, Kennedy said, Congress says it's not necessary, it's not necessary. So this is why George Annis wrote this article. I mean, his audience obviously was, you know, physicians. And in the New England Journal of Medicine article that I assigned, you know, he really wants to get the message across to doctors that, look, they're interfering with your medical judgment. I mean, in the past, the health exception, whether the woman needed an abortion based on a health exception was up to the doctor. Here, Congress has found that this procedure is never necessary to protect the health of the mother. Ginsburg's dissent. Excuse me. Go ahead.
When you said that Congress made this decision, I mean, what's the process of that? Were there any sort of
they have a
or anything involved? I mean, I would assume there had to be some sort of a doctor involved in testifying about that. They can't just exclude a significant portion of who'd be even doing this, right? So.
Well, they did have some, but they were pro-life doctors. And then Congress, you know, essentially writes a preamble to the legislation, you know, making these certain findings. And this is one of their findings, that it wouldn't be necessary to protect the life of the mother. Another interesting thing about this case is that was this law passed to protect to protect fetuses? Is this law going to save any fetus?
No. Didn't Scalia even say so? Or one of the judges in their dissents in the case actually
Ginsburg.
Said this saves
Ginsburg.
The fetus. Yeah.
Right. You know, it wasn't passed based upon the protecting potential human life. It was passed based upon moral evaluations of what doctors should and should not do. You know, they found that it was against the human dignity. It was violated human dignity of fetuses to have these laws on the books, and also that they had to protect medical ethics. These were the reasons why this law was passed.
You're welcome,
yes.
I just don't understand how that's legal at all, because something has to be trumping the woman's fundamental right. And if it's not the compelling interest in the fetus, if it's just ideas about dignity and medical ethics, then I don't see how that trumps at all. And that's, Ginsburg says that.
Right.
I don't understand how that.
Together, they had to basically say that the procedure doesn't do anything for the mom.
It doesn't protect her health.
Once they got there.
But it's. Because the procedure is never going to endanger the woman's health.
But aside from health, just the right to make the decision. Just the autonomy, liberty, like.
Well, I agree.
Something has, they're not arguing that that's not a fundamental right.
But here you can still get the abortion, you just can't use this and that.
They're just saying you're tinkering with the edges. They're prescribing a particular, they're prohibiting a particular abortion method, which does not, therefore, impose a substantial obstacle on the woman to get an abortion, you're saying.
I guess I just agree with what Ginsburg is.
Right. And you know, I did not even get to this maternal fetal relationship section. What time do you guys usually?
You did warn me that this is a lot of material.
What?
You did warn me that this is
a lot of
material.
I know. I want to go just some major cases in the area of maternal fetal relationship and regulation of pregnant women's behavior. This really has to do with two areas, coerced medical treatment.
Sorry, thank you.
Criminal prosecution of pregnant women. There was a case this past year, the Samantha Burton case, which is discussed in the article I assigned. Can anybody describe what happened in that case? It was in Florida. A woman who was pregnant, were you gonna?
Was gonna say, like, the problem with precedent, like, not caring about the, I'm forgetting the woman's name.
Angela Carter?
Yeah. probably do better than that.
Right. Well, I'm just opening with the Samantha Burton case because it just happened this year. And I assigned this Hastings Center Report article on it. Howard Minkoff and Annie Lyerly are both obstetricians, the authors of that, on ACOG's ethics committee.
They forced her, or were trying to force her to have bed rest, and she already had kids at home and
mm-hmm.
like single mother, only one supporting the kids, but they wouldn't,
mm-hmm.
they were, I guess the doctors were supportive of doing the
Doctors went to court. Her OB went to court to try to enforce bed rest. Excuse me.
I thought it was the hospital that did that.
Doctors started the procedure.
Oh, okay.
This woman went to her OB. She was having pregnancy complications. She had two kids at home. The OB said, you need to be on bed rest. She said, I want a second opinion. She was not allowed to leave the hospital. They immediately went to court, and she was forced to stay in the hospital. She wasn't allowed to get a second opinion. She also wasn't allowed a lawyer. Part of this case was based upon the fact that they denied her rights to representation. And I don't know if you read about it in the press, but it was got a lot of press at the time. So based upon one doctor's recommendations, this woman was forcibly required to stay in the hospital. She did eventually have the child, and it was born dead. In August, the Florida appellate court said, you can't do this. Essentially, the district court had said the child is, the fetus was like a child under the abuse statutes, and therefore we're protecting it. Whether the fact that it's inside this woman is kind of irrelevant, we're protecting the child, she's on bed rest. They said you can't include the children under the fetal abuse statutes. Children, I keep saying children, fetus, under the child abuse statutes. And they, a previous case to this, which is very an important precedent, but which is still ignored by courts, was the Angela Carter case. This was a forced cesarean case. Does anybody want to describe what happened in that case?
She was a 27-year-old woman who she had bone cancer, and she said she didn't want any life sustaining measures for the child if it was prior to 28 weeks, but then her cancer resurfaced somewhere. And it was like 25 or 26 weeks. It was before the 28-week mark, and her and her family both said they didn't want the fetus to be saved, mm-hmm. but they forced the hospital. That was where the hospital, I think, went.
Right, the physician supported the family decision.
Right,
yeah.
And then the hospital took it
mm-hmm.
to court, and they forced her to have a C-section, and then they both died.
Yes, the baby died in 2 hours, and she died 2 days later.
2 days later or something.
Arguably, partly, her death was partly hastened by the cesarean. So the issue then is, can you force pregnant women to undergo medical treatment for the benefit of the fetus, including a cesarean, which is a major surgery, can have complications. You know, you can die from a cesarean. And the AC court found that that was not allowable. Because you can't force a person to, under the McFall versus Shemp case, which we talked about before, you can't force a person to undergo medical treatment for the benefit of the other. That's probably really the more proper paradigm to impose on these types of cases instead of the abortion scenario. I just want to do one more case and then we'll close. This was a really terrible case. The same hospital as Burton in 1999 in the Pemberton versus Tallahassee Memorial Hospital case. This was a U.S. District Court. A mother had previous cesareans. She wanted to have a VBAC, which is vaginal birth after cesarean, which in 1999 was not very easy to find, still is very difficult to find physicians who will do this. So she decided to have her baby at home with a nurse midwife. She labored for a while, but she started to get dehydrated. She went to the hospital, to the ER, for purposes of getting IV fluids. The OB, the doctor who saw her, called in an OB, and the OB said, you have to have a cesarean. You can't have a VBAC at home. This is endangering the child.